Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, 2 months out from Election Day, both presidential candidates are talking a lot about the other guy.
No one will be safe in Biden's America.
Fires are burning and we have a president who fans the flames rather than fighting the flames.
We'll spend this hour with Washington Week moderator and Washington Post national political reporter Robert Costa talking about how the economy, the pandemic, and ongoing racial unrest will shape our decision-making this year. Our conversation starts after a short break. That have gone virtual feel a little watered down. A YouTube concert does not match the excitement of a live stadium event, and doing kindergarten via Zoom is probably less engaging than the real thing. And yet it turns out mostly virtual presidential campaigns can get just as nasty as the nonstop roadshows that would be happening if not for the pandemic.
He may believe mouthing the words law and order makes him strong. But his failure to call on his own supporters to stop acting as an armed militia in this country shows how weak he is.
Joe Biden is not a savior of America's soul. He is the destroyer of America's jobs. And if given the chance, he will be the destroyer of American greatness.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Robert Costa has been covering this very unusual campaign season as national political reporter for The Washington Post and moderator of Washington Week on PBS. We wanted to talk with him about what the Biden and Trump campaigns are promising to do to solve the pandemic, the evaporation of millions of jobs, and the ongoing unrest over police brutality against Americans of color, and the way some protests and counter-protests have exploded into violence. Robert, welcome to Think.
Hey, oh, it's great to be with you.
What is it like to be a national political reporter in 2020 when the president himself constantly warns Americans that everything negative written about him or the party is fake news? I wonder if that has changed the way you put stories together to the extent that, you know, many people who read your reporting might come to it from a place of distrust.
They may come to it from that position, but my position and the position of The Washington Post is to just be brutally frank as much as possible, to fact check in real time and to not shy away from that responsibility. And while some people may want to read a more anodyne piece of newspaper or read something that's just more kind of generic in its summary of the news, it's not the responsibility of a national political reporter to just kind of check the box. You have to provide context, fact checking, but you also still want to have the color and the life and the vigor of American politics and talk to voters and people inside campaigns. And so it's a joyful experience still to be a reporter, despite the times.
What are the biggest takeaways for you from the two conventions this year that were unlike anything in living memory?
The biggest takeaway from the Republican convention is that this is a party that's in the grip of Donald Trump. And President Trump, ever since that convention in Cleveland in 2016, but really before then, that elevator ride at Trump Tower in 2015, he has had Republican voters in thrall. And so many Republicans now, it's almost a cliche, they're muted. When I call them up on the phone, it almost instantly goes to background or off the record in terms of talking about President Trump. Such an aversion to counter him, to stand up to him. And when I ask them why this is, they acknowledge they are appalled at times by his conduct, his shattering of democratic norms, but they see him as an all-powerful figure within the party, and they don't really know how to compete with that. And they also want his political capital as they seek to win re-elections in their districts or their states. The biggest takeaway from the Democratic convention is that this is actually a very fractured party. It has similar problems to the Republicans in terms of the divide between a base that's more socialist on the Democratic side, Democratic socialist, just like the Republican base is kind of more nationalist celebrity in its makeup. But the Democrats have papered over a lot of their differences and united around Vice President Biden as their standard bearer. And for now, they're going to carry through for the next 60 or so days with him and Senator Harris at the top of the ticket. But that doesn't mean if Biden wins the White House that somehow it's going to be kumbaya on the Democratic side in 2021.
You reported that former President Obama was instrumental in bringing Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden together in time for the convention. How did that all go down?
Well, it was more Senator Sanders and who he is than President Obama nudging him along. President Obama has had this behind-the-scenes role that's been important. But Senator Sanders is someone who I've spent a lot of time with over the past decade covering him. And he's a historic American figure, someone who came from the fringes of the left to change the way the Democrats talk about free college, Medicare for all. He's changed the Democratic agenda and the way people articulate ideas on the Democratic side. But he also sees President Trump as a threat to American democracy, an existential threat, not just a competing political figure, but an existential threat. And because of that, he has gotten behind Vice President Biden, who he was at times on a political level, not personally, vicious toward, calling out Biden's position on trade and his vote for supporting Iraq intervention years ago.
Is it likely that Sanders and his ideas will have a lasting impact on Democratic policy moving forward? I mean, to what extent did he permanently broaden the influence of the most liberal wing of the party?
Well, we only have to look at what happened in Massachusetts this week on Tuesday night when Senator Markey was able to beat a Kennedy in a Massachusetts primary. It's not heard of going back to when JFK first started running for the House in the 1940s. And Markey won because of the power of his own ideas, which are coupled together with those of Ocasio-Cortez and, of course, Senator Sanders. Senator Sanders reminds me of a Barry Goldwater type figure on the left. You think about Barry Goldwater in 1964 loses in a landslide to LBJ, and the conservatives are kind of written off as they don't have enough to put together a coalition. But the Goldwater campaign laid the foundation for Ronald Reagan to run in 76, then again and win the White House in 1980, and to bring conservatism to the fore. In that sense, I see Sanders as bringing democratic socialism slowly but surely to the forefront of democratic politics. It may take a few more cycles, though, for his wing to capture the nomination.
Do you have any sense of why Bernie Sanders failed to connect with black voters in the way that Biden did?
Well, he connected in a different way in 2020 than he did in 2016. It was disastrous for Sanders in South Carolina. And when you talk to Jeff Weaver and Tad Devine and some of his advisors from that 16 run, they say they knew next time around if he ran, it was going to have to change. And Sanders made enormous inroads in 2020 with Latino voters. You look at his take in the Nevada caucuses. This is someone who was putting together different communities of color in a new way. His coalition in Iowa, I saw it up close, was a lot of working class Latino voters working in agriculture in Des Moines and Cedar Rapids in those areas. And I saw that up close as a reporter. But his struggle with real, his confidants tell me that part of his problem is he never wants to tie together his own personal narrative to his own politics, that he wants to keep it about the so-called movement. But there's a drawback in doing that because Sanders, as you know, was arrested in the 1960s as a student at the University of Chicago for protesting segregation, for being a civil rights activist. But he was never seen as someone who was in solidarity by some rank and file black voters in places like the Deep South, who saw him as this kind of liberal from the Northeast, from the tiny state of Vermont. And so it was a failure on Sanders' part to tell his own story. And part of it was just, it was not so much Sanders' failings, but Biden's reputation as someone who had been at Barack Obama, the first black president's side, for 8 years, gave him such entrenched support in that community with people like Representative Clyburn, that South Carolina was ripe for Biden from the start. And even as he veered off for months and fell in the polls, South Carolina always kind of held there as a steady place for Biden.
Does anything stand out to you from the Democratic platform that might not have made it there in a more typical year than 2020?
Well, you see right now, not so much in the Democratic platform, but the Democratic message, a balancing a little bit in the rhetoric. Biden is not embracing the idea of defunding for police. He's making clear he does not support that idea. And he gave a speech in Pittsburgh earlier this week saying that he does not stand with the looters or those who are causing violence. And it's a difficult thing for Biden to navigate because he's in his upper 70s. He comes from a different generation. And he also doesn't want to be Bill Clinton in 1992. You think back to Bill Clinton had his famous or infamous sister soldier moment where he called out a black woman, a rap musician named Sister Soulja, for her comments about the Rodney King riots. And he was seen as appealing to white moderates in the suburbs by taking on Sister Soulja. But that episode has caused a lot of pain among black voters I've spoken with because they feel like Bill Clinton picked an unnecessary fight against a black woman to score points with white voters. And Biden in 2020 doesn't just want to pick a fight with a figure from black culture or black politics as a way of winning over white voters like Clinton did in 1992. So you see Biden trying to take on directly violence in the streets, but he wants to also show solidarity with the millions of people who are walking as part of these Black Lives Matter protests nationwide.
So what sort of role will Kamala Harris take on in the remainder of this campaign?
When Vice President Pence was running for VP in 2016, his handlers used to joke to me that he was running for governor in a few states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. And he was really going to just stay in those states and appeal to evangelical and Christian suburban voters, white voters, to make sure they came out. And you're going to see with Senator Harris an appeal to voters on several fronts. One, she's historic as a female candidate for vice president. We've seen Geraldine Ferraro and Sarah Palin before, but still historic to see a black woman with also South Asian heritage on the Democratic ticket. And so she wants to make sure she's in places to remind people about the power of her candidacy, of having a woman with her background and stature as a California senator, member of the Judiciary Committee, in the place where she's at. But it's also going to be limited, I'm told, because of the way we're all on Microsoft Teams or Zoom or Skype, and she can only be so many places physically, but she's going to try to connect with women in different areas. She's going to also try to connect with women in suburban areas because she sees the Trump campaign and the Biden people see the Trump campaign with this law and order message. And she has her own law and order message that caused her problems in the primary because a lot of Democrats on the left side of the party don't love a prosecutor going after people for different kinds of felonies. But that prosecutorial edge, which hurt her, could actually help her in a general election context in terms of reassuring some voters that Vice President Biden does not stand with those looters or whomever else is causing unease in these areas.
How has Mike Pence's profile changed in the 4 years he's been vice president? Is he still serving to sort of solidify evangelical voters Trump's intentions?
Yes and no. President Trump is a well-known commodity. He was well-known to evangelicals then in 2016, but Paul Manafort, who's now had all his legal trouble, when he really pushed Trump to pick Pence, it was to shore up that evangelical support. And they weren't sure about President Trump, this former Democrat who had flip-flopped on abortion, whether he would really be a solid for them in the White House. And Pence went around and told them that it would all work out just fine. And in the eyes of many evangelicals, it actually has worked out just fine politically for them. And it's something to always watch is that on a personal level, many of these conservative voters, religious voters, don't really connect with President Trump as a person, New York personality and everything else with his conduct, but they do see him as someone who came through on overhauling the judiciary along with Mitch McConnell in the Senate, installing conservatives on the Supreme Court, and they see him as a trustworthy nominee of conservative justices. And for many people on that right wing of the Republican Party, what they really want is not a politician who looks like them or sounds like them. They want a politician who gives them power, and Trump has given them power.
My guest is Robert Costa. He's national political reporter for The Washington Post and moderator of Washington Week on PBS. We're talking this hour about the 2020 election season, the issues that will motivate Americans to vote. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Washington Post national political reporter and Washington Week moderator Robert Costa. We're talking about the 2020 election season. Robert, I am still trying to get my head around the fact that the GOP did not create a new platform for 2020. What do you know about that decision?
That was a decision that was really driven by Jared Kushner, the president's senior advisor and son-in-law inside the White House. And it's emblematic of how this White House owns the Republican Party, but it operates often without following Republican guidance or the traditions of the Republican Party. And as someone who's covered conventions for years, the activists, the RNC members love creating this platform, but the White House wanted total control. And so they effectively took control of the Republican National Committee, as they have for in recent years, and said, we're not doing a platform. It's just going to be an agenda. And the agenda boiled down to just some bullet points with things as generic as solve the pandemic and other such things. And it shows you that President Trump really is not running on a specific policy or agenda this time around. It's a personality. And he has struggled at times, the president has, to articulate and describe what exactly he would do in a second term, rather than just saying he's going to continue what he's doing, which is effectively what he said in these interviews.
Some Democrats are furious that the president turned the White House grounds into a kind of convention venue. I mean, it is an atypical year in terms of this pandemic. Is that kind of issue really sinking in with voters? Do people care that much?
Even Vice President Biden has said people don't pay attention to the Hatch Act, and that's the act that prevents federal employees from getting involved in politics. But the line is so blurred. You see cabinet officials like Secretary of State Pompeo speaking from Israel at the Republican convention, other cabinet members speaking, federal employees from Ivanka Trump to Kellyanne Conway giving remarks at a political convention. And you see throughout the government these tensions when Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, General Milley, was involved with the president walking across Lafayette Square, along with Secretary Esper from the Defense Department. It raised some alarm inside of those circles about whether the military was getting too close to politics and to the president. But whether people pay a political cost, I think VP Biden is right in his assessment based on my own reporting. People are concerned about public corruption broadly, but whether they individually follow these cases and say the White House should or shouldn't be used, a lot of these politicians just believe they have leeway because they're not being forced to pay a cost. The stories seem to evaporate, but they really shouldn't evaporate. I mean, this is federal land. It is a pandemic, and I'm not here to criticize it or praise it, but this is taxpayer money being used in part to support these events and staff these events, and they are explicitly political in nature. And if this is what people accept, so be it. But the reporting must continue.
Democrats are also highly attuned to the sort of breakaway Republicans, Jeff Flake, George Conway, Bill Weld, other people who have chosen to position themselves outside the Trump orbit. How much influence does this wing of the party have with general Republican voters?
That's just such an open question. I've done extensive reporting for The Washington Post about the Lincoln Project, and that's this group of the never Trumpers, the anti-Trumpers, who are coming together with these ads that are very effective in terms of drawing eyeballs and clicks on social media, millions of views into the Lincoln Project's videos. But you do wonder when you report out these stories, whether the Lincoln Project and other such anti-Trump Republican groups are doing more to actually excite the left than draw in more on the right, because the Republicans remain almost in lockstep around 90% in most polls with President Trump, despite all of his challenges and his problems and scandals. And you see many, many liberals being enthusiastic about the Lincoln Project because they see it as almost sharper edge than anything the Biden campaign or the Democratic National Committee would do. And the Lincoln Project, as an outside advocacy group, can get very personal. It goes after President Trump's mental health, his physical health. It's mocking, it's scornful. And so it has this razor edge to it that a lot of the president's fiercest critics just love. But we're not seeing a huge amount of Republican breakaway. The most important aspect of the Lincoln Project, in my view, is how it could actually damage Senate candidates. Whereas a lot of people who are on the Republican side see President Trump as a cudgel against any perceived foe they have, whether it's the establishment, the business types, the media, whatever the Democrats, whoever they don't like. Senate candidates, like let's say Martha McSally in Arizona, a Republican who's having a tough race, if she starts to be, get some soft Republican support, she's been mocked by the Lincoln Project in ads. You could see the Lincoln Project having and such groups having a corrosive effect on Senate candidates on the Republican side, and maybe flicking some of those Republicans who are not really into those candidates and those Trump favored candidates, flicking a little bit of that support away.
So the pandemic is top of mind for a lot of Americans across the political spectrum because in some way or another, it's affecting the way just about everyone lives in this country. You've reported on the White House's focus on this sort of waxing and waning over time, which is interesting because it seems like, although it's a very difficult challenge to solve, it's the kind of thing that, the president could be positioning himself as really engaged with benefit of his campaign and American sense that he's got this under control.
These stories I've written with my colleagues at the Washington Post over, let's say, the last 6-7 months have been kind of consumed my year as a reporter. And to me, when you step back, it'll be, I think, the big story of 2020 is President Trump's handling of the pandemic. And what we've done every month is just try to trace what exactly has happened here. And you're right. Presidents often try to take control of crisis moments and position themselves as national leaders, almost nonpartisan figures as they look toward reelection, whether it was George H.W. Bush in 1991 with the Gulf War, President George W. Bush with 9/11, Ronald Reagan after the Challenger explosion. Whenever these national incidents happen, presidents try to kind of get outside of their partisan box and really be seen as the president. And totally occupy that office as an idea, as a political function. But the president, his actions speak louder than anything else he can say. Whether it was saying the virus will disappear, it's not as bad as the seasonal flu, recommending bleach perhaps as a possible treatment, touting hydroxychloroquine as a prophylactic or treatment, even as the Food and Drug Administration issue warnings about how it could affect heart health. I could go on and on with how President Trump has inserted himself into the center of this entire process and often gone against the wishes of his own medical professionals and the doctors at his side, and given people and the American people public information that is at times not rooted at all in fact or reality.
How concrete are Joe Biden's proposals for dealing with the pandemic, and is he getting any traction with that?
He's getting more traction just being seen as a steadier pair of hands. You see this in the polling. His plan is more of a stimulus idea. He would come in and try to inject money into the economy, into government programs to address the pandemic, whether it's schools or health programs, vaccine development. But the Biden plan is really about management at the top. And who do you want running the federal response? And he's casting his experience here as an asset rather than a liability.
So with regard to police violence, racial unrest, some destruction happening now, you know, counter protest violence that's happening, it feels as if Joe Biden is trying to sort of, walk a middle road on this to condemn police violence, but also any kind of protest or destruction. President Trump has gone all in on the other side. And I wonder, in this year, given the tenor of emotions around these issues, which is the riskier stand to take?
Well, Biden's whole career has been as a law and order Democrat. You think back to 1994, he was one of the shepherds of that major crime bill that has since come under scrutiny for how he worked with President Clinton on that crime bill. But Biden used to brag when he was in the well of the Senate. He would say in the 90s and the 2000s, every single crime bill going back to the 1970s that's been bipartisan in nature, every single one of them has had the Biden name affixed to it. He was proud of his record as a law and order Democrat. And that's who he is. As much as he was vice president for 8 years with President Obama, President Obama wasn't uber focused on criminal justice reform or crime. And part of the reason Biden was put on the ticket in 2008 is he was seen as this law and order Democrat who also had the foreign policy gravitas as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And so what you're seeing now is a man at the end of his career, looking to have this term as president, in Joe Biden, who has always been kind of this law and order Democrat, but he sees a national racial reckoning happening, and he wants to be part of that. That's why he's going to Kenosha. He's going to have a community meeting. He's going to try to talk to the stakeholders, and he knows this is a country that has changed dramatically since the early 90s, since the early 70s when he first jumped into public office. It's changed dramatically even in the last 6 months because of what happened with George Floyd and the way so many Black Americans feel under siege, rightfully so, from white police officers. And it's a balancing act for him because he is who he is, but he also wants to be the person who gives the country a choice, an option that's different from President Trump's walking with Bill Barr through Kenosha and talking about law and order.
We have an email here from Jill who asks if you'll talk about the meaning of the silent majority that Trump uses to address his followers. She wants to know if it still holds the same meaning now that it once did.
It's a great question. The silent majority goes back to Richard Nixon and the 1968 and 72 campaigns for president. And that whole approach to kind of working class ethnic voters, white voters, and we're talking about kind of the Irish, Italian voters in New York and then the Mid-Atlantic region and other parts of the country, the Midwest, who in the 70s were frustrated with the Vietnam protests and went about their lives and were not involved in civil rights activism, not involved in anti-war activism, became the silent majority in the eyes of Republicans like Nixon, who used that as a way of painting a broad brush on this whole group of mostly white voters who were fed up with activism across the board. And President Trump, who has been advised at times by Roger Stone, who worked for Nixon and has had connections to populists and law and order messages his entire career, including the Central Park Five, which he's been heavily criticized for, and having all these strong opinions on race and being accused frequently of racism. And in the Washington Post, in my own reporting, we've talked about how his rhetoric is racist and his actions at times can be racist in terms of who they affect and how they affect people. But the silent majority is still here in a sense because law and order is a revival of an appeal to people who are unhappy with activism on the racial front. But this is a different country than it was in 1968, 1970. And many people are not living only in white enclaves. Some, sure they are, but the suburbs in places like Atlanta and Milwaukee, Philadelphia, are far more diverse in 2020 in class, in ethnic background, racial background, than they were in 1968, 1970. But President Trump, he comes out of this Roy Cohn, Roger Stone mentality, this political ethos, where he still believes these kind of naked, raw appeals to the so-called silent majority can still have potent political impact.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go to the phones now. Matthew is on the line in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, go right ahead.
Okay, yes. So my question is, I grew up evangelical, and so I understand how a lot of evangelicals think. And even though I myself voted Democrat in the last election, I know that a lot of them are single-issue voters when it comes to the issue of abortion. And over the years, I haven't really seen the Democrats try to talk about that in more moderate ways, such as emphasizing reducing abortion. And I was just wondering, is that a possible blind spot over the years with Democrats?
Thanks for calling.
So when you look at the abortion issue, it has kept a lot of the evangelical voters moving into the Democratic column. I mean, the last Democrat who was able to get enormous evangelical support was Jimmy Carter in 1976, himself an evangelical Christian. And Bill Clinton, to a point, and President Obama, to a point, have always had some evangelical support. It's not like it's a monolith entirely. But Jimmy Carter, to me, was a reporter, was kind of that last evangelical Democrat. But Biden, probably not getting enough attention, is a member of the Roman Catholic faith, and he supports abortion rights. And so that, in the eyes of some conservative Catholic voters, has complicated his appeal to them on a faith level. But President Trump was criticized for calling Biden godless the other day, and Biden hit back hard, talking about his own faith and how he attends mass. And you see there, in the Catholic Church even, there are divisions that could be to Biden's benefit in the sense that the Catholic vote won't maybe necessarily all go to President Trump just because of the abortion issue. There's the social justice wing of the Catholic Church, representative more than anyone by Pope Francis himself, which has a little bit more of a liberal view, not on the issue of abortion, but just in terms of how they speak about poverty and reaching out to different groups who have been disenfranchised. And Biden has support from some of those leading Catholic Democrats who on abortion take kind of the Biden Mario Cuomo position, which is they're not going to fight Roe versus Wade as a court decision, as a legal right, but they do want to make appeals to Catholics and other evangelical and religious voters on different grounds. But the conservative side of the politics in this country has made abortion first and foremost the issue. In many of these churches I've visited, Catholic or evangelical. And so it's going to be hard at times for Biden to chip away how much abortion has become that searing and kind of unifying political issue for many in the religious community.
My guest is Robert Costa. He is moderator of Washington Week on PBS and national political reporter for The Washington Post. We're talking this hour about 2020 election season, the issues that are motivating Americans to vote. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour about the 2020 election season with Robert Costa, who is national political reporter for The Washington Post and moderator of Washington Week on PBS. Robert, I want to make clear that it's not at all unusual for a presidential advisor, close presidential advisor, to leave around the end of a president's first term. That said, Kellyanne Conway's tenure in this particular White House has been longer than almost any of her colleagues. How significant is her departure, and does it mean anything other than what she says it means, which is that she wants to spend more time with her family?
Well, I'm not going to get into the family side of what she's dealing with. It's been reported out there, and people can discover that matter on their own. But as someone who's covered her for years, she to me is the survivor of the Trump White House. I mean, and she's also a symbol of what the Trump White House represents. She was the campaign manager. She came in with Steve Bannon in the summer of 2016, almost 4 years ago this month. And she came in and they won, stunned everyone, including themselves, it seemed at times, that they won the White House. And she has been someone who came out of the New York, New Jersey world of politics, had known President Trump and Mr. Trump for years, had actually lived in a Trump building, that she was able to kind of speak to him with candor and navigate around Jared Kushner and others who had their own agendas or their own power centers. She was able to float in a way to do things like opioid addiction as a policy area she focused on, but really she was a political advisor in this White House. And she would be allied to a point with whomever was serving as chief of staff, whether it was Reince Priebus or John Kelly, but she always kind of had her own stature with the president. And her decision to leave just, 65, 70 days before the election is, she says, a family-driven decision. But then at the same time, you see at the end of a first term, so many people throughout presidential history are kind of burned out and will either go on the outside for the second term, or if there is a second term, maybe think about another position, because Democrat or Republican, these White Houses are pressure cookers, to say the least. And this one, I mean, I think I can speak for all of us, perhaps 3.5 years after covering this White House, and maybe for some of you listening, just living as this White House goes about its business, it's intense and it's a lot. And maybe people don't want to spend 8 years in that kind of intensity.
Joe Biden keeps talking about how President Trump plans to at least indirectly steal the election. Is that just a page out of Trump's playbook to preemptively accuse the other side of nefarious intentions? And could it backfire for Biden?
4 years ago, Trump campaign allies and advisors used to tell me that if President Trump lost, then candidate Trump lost in 2016, they never would have. They believed he never would concede. He would refuse to concede. He would have went to Mar-a-Lago and said the election was rigged. And that was the plan kind of in 2016. And then he won. he won the White House. So that plan never came to be. But that's what was articulated, described to me behind the scenes. It's kind of the MO, should he have been defeated. And this time around, not much has changed. This is a president who, more than anyone, values his brand as a winner, someone who is just doesn't lose. And so his refusal to accept a loss is so much a personal thing, I'm told, by his confidants and advisors, that he doesn't want to be seen as a loser. But it has enormous consequences for American democracy, and it's throwing the idea of a peaceful transition of power, which we talked about Nixon, a peaceful transition of power. You think about him going up with the V fingers in the air on Marine One, giving power over to Gerald Ford. Even in the darkest moments of American democracy, there's been a peaceful transition of power. But as violence is happening in the streets, you have one of the president's supporters shooting a gun during a protest. You see violence from police officers, violence from some of these riots. Now a president threatening to not accept the election result. It is a cauldron of threats to a democracy that's already in a fragile state.
We have an email here from John about the Electoral College. John says, if Biden wins the popular vote but loses the Electoral College, as Hillary did, what do you imagine the reaction from the majority of voters would be? And is this cause for concern?
Well, there will certainly be protests, but it is the system we live under. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but if you want to reform, you're going to need to have a popular movement to reform the whole Constitution and amend the Constitution to move toward a popular vote system. And every year, I'm told people want to move in parts of this country in that direction. But because of the way this entire country's political system is structured, where people in Wyoming and Delaware and smaller states with smaller populations still want to have two senators, they still want to be involved in the political process, like in Iowa and New Hampshire, and still be influential. No, but every 4 years, it seems to go a bit higher in terms of the momentum of changing this Electoral College system. I mean, I'm always asked by voters, why does Iowa get to have such influence over who's picked? This lily white state in the Midwest, New Hampshire, this flinty state in New England, and South Carolina has diverse population, more Black Americans live there, but it's still kind of a small state. But it takes political will and organizing to amend the Constitution, and we haven't seen it. And it could lead, as your questioner asked, to a crisis. We're a country at times that seems to be moving from crisis to crisis rather than from crisis to solution. And I wouldn't be surprised to see a popular uproar if that situation unfolded.
Should we be concerned about the fair and accurate processing of the large number of mail-in ballots expected this year? What do your sources tell you about the ability of the Postal Service to make this happen?
Well, the Postal Service is being attacked as an institution by the administration it serves, by the Trump administration. But in terms of whether you should be afraid or others should be afraid of the integrity of the vote, I would only point to my own reporting and the Washington Post reporting, which does not show widespread voter fraud in terms of mail-in voting. Are there anecdotal examples of mail-in voting being tampered with at some point? Yes. And when I interviewed Steve Scalise, the Republican whip, the other day, he had a list ready of different anecdotal examples of fraud. And I don't discount that there is evidence of some fraud at some level. But what's important here in a country of hundreds of millions of people is that there's not widespread evidence of voter fraud when it comes to mail-in voting. Many people vote by absentee ballot, which is very similar, at least in terms of it's processed through the mail in a safe and efficient way. So at this point, the Postal Service is closing down offices. It's closing down different mailboxes. And so access to the post office and speed is going to be the issue. When I talked to Jen O'Malley Dillon, the Biden campaign manager, the other day for a lengthy interview, her message came down to, if you're a Biden voter, make sure you're mailing in your ballot as soon as possible. Get it done early so it can be processed soon.
All right, back to the phones now. We have Mark on the line in Dallas. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning. Well, I suppose it's afternoon. Hey, I have an observation and a prediction. And if you disagree, Mr. Costa, I wonder if you could tell me why you think I'm wrong. But it seems obvious to me that the DNC was frankly terrified by the Bernie candidacy and the quote-unquote insurgent left. And so Biden now is more or less disavowing that fringe of the party, let's say, and actively, attempting to position himself as a moderate to appeal to that swing Republican voter, the elusive moderate Republican. But my prediction is that Joe Biden will likely win the popular vote by, a small enough margin that it was brought up earlier, will probably lose the Electoral College simply because he has not energized the voters that he needs to, who would be the Democratic base. So your thoughts on that, please.
Thanks for calling.
You bring up an important challenge for Biden, which is how do you make sure that Bernie Sanders voters gets outside of the house and goes to vote or mails in that ballot. And I remember going to Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 2016 and being surprised at the lack of support, the energy on the ground for Secretary Clinton's campaign. And I would ask some of the Sanders supporters there, why aren't they organized? And they said they just had enough. They didn't really find it that important. And that was Wisconsin 4 years ago. And 4 years later, it's a little bit of a different dynamic. I mean, you think back to Philadelphia, the convention in 2016, the Sanders voters agitated, feeling like the DNC was working actively against them. Now you have Senator Sanders supporting in a full-throated way Vice President Biden. You see the Sanders campaign. Maybe Sanders supporters think it's BS, but it's the Biden people and the Sanders people seem to be pleased with it. These unity task forces that come up with an agenda that involved Representative Ocasio-Cortez and Representative Ilhan Omar. So if you're a Sanders supporter and you're wondering, does Biden take you seriously? Maybe you have skepticism if he's really listening, if he'll really pursue some of these ideas. But at the end of the day, the Biden campaign is closer to the Sanders campaign than the Sanders campaign in 16 ever was to the Clinton campaign. And that's to answer your prediction that, he doesn't have the enthusiasm on the ground. The view is hopefully in the Biden camp, they say hopefully Black voters, Latino voters will come out strong. Because they're opposed to President Trump, and the Bernie Sanders voters will feel like they're more included this time. But you're right. It's TBD. We'll see if this actually works.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Ordinarily, Robert, in a presidential election year, the economy can tell us a lot about how well the incumbent might fare. It seems in this moment, I mean, all the polling I've seen says that a majority of Americans still have more confidence in Donald Trump to handle the economy than Joe Biden. Can you explain why that's different this year?
Well, you look at these people who go out for President Trump and support him in boats. A lot of these people who buy boats, and boats are up purchases during the pandemic, are people who are maybe started out lower middle class, upper middle class, and they've accumulated enough capital to get a second home or to perhaps to buy a boat. And how do you get money for a boat? The stock market usually goes up. Your 401k goes up. Your accounts for retirement go up. And you have extra money. And the stock market, despite all the challenges in the economy and people are really struggling, the jobless rates are abhorrent. And you see it and we feel the pain of all of our friends who work in the service industry and restaurant industry. But those who are investing feel terrific. And that's part of the economic story of 2020 is President Trump was coasting, soaring with the economy earlier this year. It's now had a turbulence that's been almost unheard of in any previous time. We're talking about numbers that we haven't seen really since the 30s during the height of the pandemic when it came to the jobless data. Yet the stock market chugs ahead, has not yet had a correction. And because of that, the economic story for President Trump is one he keeps saying, well, despite everything that's happened during the pandemic, the economy was at X point earlier this year, and I can try to get it back there and the stock market's high. And people out there still have cash if they've been doing well. And those are the voters President Trump really is trying to lock in, is the suburban voter who has some capital in the stock market, make sure that they still stick with him.
The Trump campaign made a major switch recently and put Bill Stepien in charge over Brad Parscale. What was the reason for that, and has it helped the Trump team sort of revive its prospects?
Parscale was more of he's a digital operator. He's still part of the campaign, and he really helped create this whole Trump world that lives on Facebook that deserves more attention. This social media orbit where people are sharing information and memes and links all beyond kind of the gaze of the media or other political observers. It's all happening on social media platforms, and that had an enormous influence in 2016. And Pascal's still involved, but the campaign needed someone who's a little bit more operational and making sure these swing states were being locked down in terms of strategy. And Bill Stepien, who comes out of the Chris Christie wing of the Republican Party, he was known as a real operational guy. And you don't see Bill Stepien on TV talking about the latest talking points. It's another collection of allies who are out there as front-facing advisors. Bill Stepien's your classic behind-the-scenes backroom guy who's making sure the polls in Michigan are and the messages in Michigan are being adjusted correctly, that the operations, the political machines have what they need.
I imagine you are doing less traveling than you ordinarily would in the last couple of months of a presidential race. Is it any less exhausting to cover this one?
Well, the only time I really got to travel recently, I went to West Texas. I'm sure it's not as beautiful as North Texas, but I went to Odessa with President Trump. And when you travel with President Trump as a reporter in the pool, you get tested for COVID and you fly in Air Force One and you kind of write up the pool reports. So that's always an experience to see the president up close and do his kind of campaigning and governing at the same time. But that's the one thing I really miss is this time of year, whether it was 08 or 12 or 16, my life in the summer of a presidential campaign in the fall is to meet and talk with voters. And I'm trying to do it as much as possible, but not easy.
Robert Costa is national political reporter for The Washington Post and moderator of Washington Week on PBS. Robert, it's been really interesting. Thanks for making time to speak with us.
Thank you very much.
You can like our page on Facebook. We are on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get podcasts by searching for KERA Think or listen to what you've missed on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.